Is there a real Chamber of Secrets? What lies inside the ancient Padmanabhaswamy Temple in India? It's a mysterious door is protected by two massive painted cobras. It has no bolts, latches, or other visible means of entry. And it's believed that the door was sealed shut by sound waves from a secret chant lost in time. Hindu priests say that at present, there is no human capable of opening this door by executing the necessary chants. So what's inside? Jewels and gold? Spirits of the beyond? A portal? Ancient scrolls? Well, the secrets of the Padmanabhaswamy Temple run as deep as its history. And we're going to bring you the investigative research and remote viewing we can collect on it. Join me, Rob Counts, and John Vivanco for another metaphysical show that's out of this world.
This is going to be an epic episode.
I have a feeling it is going to be. I had never even heard of the Padmanabhaswamy Temple before a good friend of mine brought it up and wanted to know what our opinion on this thing was. And as I started looking into this temple, it got weirder and weirder until you did some cursory remote viewing before our Naga episode. And then you were like, dude, I need more time to view this.
Right.
It's wild. Like, it's a crazy story, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we don't hear a lot of what goes on in India, especially as it's related to these temples in general. I mean, this is huge news in India, what's going on with this temple, what's been going on with this temple. But, you know, for us, it's just, we don't hear about this. Don't get it here.
Yeah, well, this Padmanabhaswamy Temple, I just want to say, I apologize to any of our Indian watchers out there or viewers if I am pronouncing this wrong. We're giving it our best shot. We've actually heard a number of different ways of pronouncing this. And the best way is just to go ahead and say it.
So. Just massacre it. Best way is just massacre it.
Just yeah, and hope for the best, really. It's a Hindu temple that is dedicated to Vishnu. Now, Vishnu it's a deity in ancient Indian culture. There are six chambers or vaults, but possibly more in this temple. It's located in Kerala, India, very, very far south. So we're talking about kind of that tip in India. It is considered the world's richest Hindu temple, even according to the Guinness Book of World Records. Forbes actually has an article, and it was a $1 trillion hidden treasure chamber is discovered at India's Sri Padmanabhaswamy Temple.
Yeah, I think that $1 trillion, honestly, I think it's way beyond that. I know that's the estimate, but I think it's way beyond that. And I think it goes in, well, I know it goes into things that are, you can't put a monetary value on.
Well, my perspective on this too is like, well, first of all, when was the temple built? Do we know that?
Yeah, we do know that. I mean, we should know that, but I wouldn't necessarily trust those time frames.
This is kind of what I'm getting at right now, is that I have a feeling that we're talking about, if we're talking about the amount of gold and riches and stuff that I think is there based on some of these estimates and stuff like that, I don't think this stuff was just from this civilization. It had to have been left over from a previous civilization, right? Like, I mean, how do you get that much riches? For everybody at home watching right now, when we start going over some of the details of some of the things that are in these chambers, you're going to understand why I'm saying that. So I'm just going to keep going with revealing some of this data.
But, right, exactly. Yeah. And what you're saying, I mean, I know you don't know what the remote viewing data is because I haven't told you about it, but what you're saying is going down a path of where that temple couldn't have been created first.
It's called the Golden Temple far back into history. So some think it was full of gold even in the distant past, which is what John and I were just talking about. And there's evidence the walls were even lined at one point with pure gold. And we're not sure if any of this has been looted at all. But yeah, there are stories of deities, like physical form deities, visiting the people there, sometimes in disguise as children. And we'll get back to this later as well. Now, in 1680 AD, there was a miracle. a marauder planned to plunder the temple of its riches using mercenaries, but hundreds of divine serpents, the Naga, materialized and scared them away. The divine intervention inspired the locals to rise up and keep the mercenaries from trying again.
Well, yeah, there's the Naga coming in to protect, which is interesting. I mean, you know, if this is like, because, you know, we've seen that the Naga are a real thing, as in the last episode, they're a real entity, real being. So you got to wonder, like, how old is this story? And did the Naga step forward in order to block something?
Yeah. And for those of you at home, if you haven't watched our Naga episode, the previous one to this, definitely recommend doing that, because actually some of the things that they mention here, you and I discussed, where the Naga were capable of kind of going in and out of dimensions. So it is, I mean, according to what we were discussing, possible that they actually materialized and scared them away. Now, after an extensive history, in 1750, the Kingdom of Travancore, under the Travancore family, dedicated the temple to Padmanabhaswamy, the main deity of the temple. They swore each king and his descendants would be agents of the deity who would serve the kingdom. So the king's official titles had Sri Padmanabha Dasa before the names. Many statues and carvings to Vishnu, aka Padmanabhaswamy. So Vishnu was like one of these forms. So there's also carvings in the temple of serpents. There are shrines and idols to many other beings there as well.
It's quite fascinating to not only like read and study the mythology, or what they say is mythology, around these temples, but also when you get to this idea of these other deities and other gods sort of in competition with each other on getting the people to only worship at their temple. You get back to this time frame of what we would call prehistory, and the way the gods interacted with each other and the people in these stories, right? When we get to this particular Hindu temple, we're coming from that time frame where the gods were like relevant, right? So when you speak of the Nagas and that the marauder and whatnot coming forth, you know, because we've remote viewed a lot of this, it's like my mind tends to go down that path of, oh yeah, they did that. As crazy as it sounds, oh yeah, the Naga probably did do that. The other thing too is that in the astral world, you can create astral tools. A person can create astral tools. The astral world takes a bit of effort, belief, and imagination in order to create things there. So for instance, like I've taught courses before where we've had, during the duration of the course, let's say the course is like a month or 2 months, every night a person, when they go to sleep, they begin to create in their mind's eye a location, right? A house, in a whatever they want, a beautiful location. And they go there every night. And when they go there, they imagine every tiny little aspect of it. Okay. So then all these people are working on their own location, right? Every night. And then at the end of the course, we have sort of an open house where everyone in the class on specific nights gets to go to that other person's location and experience it, right? They don't know, because everybody's told you don't say anything about your location, what it looks like or anything. They have no idea what it looks like. And then when we are gone through the open houses, people talk about what they had created. And it always lines up with the experience a person had when they go to that person's location, right? So always. So, and that is the creation of something that's astral with one mind. Now think about, if a culture believes in a certain entity, the creation and expansion of that entity, it being an astral aspect of their consciousness that they can create, that can take on a life of its own. When you get to the Naga, we looked at the Naga, we could usually tell the Naga were a real thing, but there are others that are solely the creation of the consciousness, the group consciousness that temples have been built around. And now, when the thing wasn't a thing before, it is now a thing.
Right. Right.
So and that's thrown into the mix too, right?
Right. And there, this is actually, you know, what John is talking about is not a fictional thing. I mean, all over the world, there are like weird beings that get seen after people worship them. And it's like the collective energy of human beings adding to something and creating a tulpa. We've talked about this on many previous episodes, but like, yeah, it's wild, you know, and who knows, again, back to this temple, who knows the long history of this thing and what was really going on there, right? So this Travancore family that we mentioned, the temple and its assets belong to Padmanabhaswamy, once controlled by a trust headed by the Travancore family. Travancore family being like the best, you know, comparison maybe would be like the Merovingians in Europe, which were like a huge royal family that just ruled for a really long time.
Boy, have I got stories about the Merovingian beginning.
Separate episode. That'd be crazy because there's a lot to talk about there. They're the ones that are supposedly in charge of this temple. And so there's always been this like big rift between the state and the Travancore family on who actually controls the temple. Because obviously, if there's trillions of dollars in there, somebody's going to have the bright idea of like, hey, we could be rich in a second if we just somebody lets us into the vault and we literally steal a couple of things. In 2011, the Supreme Court of India directed archaeologists to open the secret chambers of the temple to inspect what was inside. There were six vaults, A through F, but two more were possibly found in 2014, and these vaults were called G and H. The vaults were opened for the purpose of making inventories. Yeah, sure. And all except B, G, and H were opened. Now, the royal family, which is the Travancore family, said that opening chamber B would be a bad omen, and it's pretty impossible to open anyway. It's unclear if these chambers were opened in the 1800s, the 1930s, or another time where they were considered to be opened, or if they've been sealed for generations. Okay, now, the mysterious door in the temple. We've got to get into this a little bit. It's protected by two massive cobras painted on it, and it has no bolts, latches, or any other means of entry. And it's believed that the door was sealed shut by sound waves from a secret chant lost in time. And Hindu priests say that at present, there is no human capable of opening this door by executing these chants properly. It's said to house unimaginable wealth and can only be entered by high-level priests familiar with the knowledge of chanting a special Garuda mantra. And Garuda is, as you know, we talked about this in the Naga episode, is a Hindu deity who is primarily depicted as the Mount Vahana of the Hindu god Vishnu. Vishnu kind of rides Garuda, but he is a deity in and of himself.
When you get to these old temples and in Tibet, in India, there is a lot of legend that they were built using sound, right? So it does exist. It is something that is a lost technology that people don't know about these days, but it is something they can do. People are building and selling, and in the scientific realm, they're experimenting in certain areas. They're experimenting a lot with sound generated levitation, and you could actually buy a little apparatus that on either side are these two little module plates that create sound. And you can put little balls in there and they'll levitate, because as the sound's going forward, they're creating, again, a standing wave. And within the standing waves, that little ball will stay stuck in the middle of the air, right? So this is just like something that humans are beginning to figure out, at least publicly at the moment.
Yeah.
But right. It's something that they knew of, that they used in the past, and they're creating a standing wave and then directing the sound as that standing wave is holding it to certain places.
Now we'll get into the known contents of the temple before going hard on this chamber of secrets that we've been alluding to. There is an estimated 22 billion worth of gold and jewels allegedly stored in the underground vaults. Six of the chambers, as we were talking about before, have already been opened, yielding approximately $22 billion worth of gold in the form of diamonds, jewelry, golden utensils, weapons, golden statues, golden elephants, and diamond necklaces. Okay, now listen to this. With one necklace having an approximate weight of around 500 kilograms, that's 1,102 pounds, and a length of around 18 feet. In addition to countless bags full of golden coins acquired from different parts of the world. Now let's go over this again. This is a necklace weighing 1,102 pounds and a length of around 18 feet. Does that sound like something a normal human could wear?
Right. No.
That's pretty wild when you think about it, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
So there are a lot of ceremonial costumes, including one with 66 pounds of solid gold coconut shells studded with rubies and emeralds. They found Napoleonic coins, Venetian jewelry, diamond belts, emeralds the size of ostrich eggs. Think about that for a sec. An emerald the size of an ostrich egg. And barrels of golden rice. Just golden rice.
Oh my gosh.
And these are just some of the treasures that have been hidden within the Padmanabhaswamy temple. Now,
man, this is like getting my like Goonies boy head going, you know.
Like, right.
Oh man.
One-eyed Willie is gonna be sitting there with all of his gold. Like, these are the temples that they've explored, but no one has been allowed into Chamber B. And mind you, I need to let everyone know that this is apparently the most secured temple in the entire world. It has the most cameras, the most security guards watching this thing at all times. It is a very, very secure temple. So, again, the most mysterious and impressive feature of this temple is a hidden chamber, which is guarded by two massive painted cobras. The legends say anyone who dares to open the door will meet with disastrous results. This mysterious door is referred to as Chamber B. Many speculate that the contents hidden inside the mysterious chamber go far beyond materialistic riches, even though priceless antiquities made of gold and diamonds await on the other side. It is believed that if any ordinary human attempts to open the mysterious Chamber B, other than by chanting the highly sacred and powerful Garuda mantra, catastrophes are likely to occur in and around the temple premises, with apocalyptic scenarios likely to follow throughout India or even the world, according to Vedic astrologers. So it's believed that beyond Chamber B lies another hidden inner chamber as well. And historical accounts suggest that another chamber exists where the mystery really lies, built out of thick walls made of solid gold. It's said to contain the largest undiscovered treasure cache in the history of the world. Furthermore, if we take a look at a book from 1933 titled Travancore, A Guidebook for the Visitor by Emily Gilchrist Hatch, we find accounts of people who tried opening the mysterious vault with disastrous results. A group of people tried entering the vaults in 1931. We mentioned that date earlier. And the result? They had to flee for their lives as they discovered a place infested with cobras. Accounts from 1908 also mentioned similar stories when the state needed money and tried to loot the vaults. So again, what I was saying before is there's been a fight between the state and the Travancore family over who should control the temple and the assets. And there are people who try to claim that Vault B was opened at least seven times since 1990, but there's no proof, you know, other than the apocalyptic state the world has been in since it turned to the new millennium. Right. But, you know, who's counting that? Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, I sometimes wonder, like J.K. Rowling had to have researched this thing, because in that movie, Chamber of Secrets, it's all about a secret chamber that Harry breaks into using like snake language, basically. He gets in and it's guarded by a huge serpent, right. Like a snake more than, you know, what you'd consider a Naga, but very similar, you know?
Right.
There's a little bit more here before we get to your remote viewing data, because there is a legend of the Padmanabhaswamy temple that we should probably just talk about briefly. The Padmanabhaswamy temple history tells that there was a sage living near where the temple is today, and he prayed to Lord Vishnu with great devotion. Vishnu then visited him disguised as a mischievous boy who took the sage's idol and defiled it. Enraged by the disrespect, the sage drove the boy away. But it was revealed to him that the little boy had been the god that he was praying to all along, so he begged for forgiveness. The voice of Vishnu directed him to go to a specific spot in the forest where Vishnu appeared in the form of a great idol leaning on his celestial hooded serpent, Adi Sheshnag. At the direction from the sage, a temple was built by the royal family at the very spot, the Padmanabhaswamy temple. So that's sort of the legend of the Padmanabhaswamy
temple. Right. On the remote viewing side of this, it was fascinating because we got a lot of different things, a lot of different things happening, a lot of different things going on. There are aspects to it that imply, like you spoke of this earlier. So there are things in there that can't be gotten out. Unless they can be disassembled, let's just say. And when we remote viewed this particular temple, we have this thing being newer construction above with very, very old underneath, right? And so old that it goes back to prehistory. So old that it was the time, like, of the Mahabharata story. And previous, the Mahabharata is the epic poem about the two families fighting in India, where you also have legends of nuclear weapons being used in that battle, right? This particular location, especially underground, goes way back, way, way, way back. In fact, in some of the data, like various bits and pieces of the data even alluded to the idea of fallen angels, a time of fallen angels, right? Some of the data does. I mean, it's like highly conceptualized because, you know, remote viewing data can use metaphors and concepts in order to explain things. And as far as the time construct goes, the type of data related would be in the time of the fallen angels, right? So when you get to that whole construct, you get that whole idea, that realm that interacted with Earth was in the Indian, if you want to use Indian terms, in the previous yuga, right? Like in the previous epochal time frame, that we are in a different one. They would consider us in the Kali Yuga right now. In that time frame was when the Mahabharata took place, that epic battle. And that epic battle was sort of a turning of the tides between these epochal times. And that would have been, and previous, the time frame that some of this stuff was put into that area. Okay, so when we remote view specifically, you know, what's going on there, what do they have? Okay, so for one thing, there are people in there. There are people in that vault. We got people down there, humans.
Well, sorry, yes. Sorry, when you say there are humans, are you talking about modern humans, or are you talking about...
I'm talking about modern humans. There are modern humans in that vault. And, you know, I mean, we do get like wealth, gold, diamonds, jewels and stuff, but that's really nothing compared to what else is down there. So
Godzilla.
Yeah, I know. Right. Godzilla. Yeah. What was described, like the bigger stuff down there, was, for one thing, an apparatus of like these big, huge circular things that are stacked plates, and each plate has a different material and they're all connected up, and they are causing a large electromagnetic disturbance that is causing certain types of things in there, conductive things, to levitate. So what we have there are parts, large parts, of what looks like Vimana, which would be that ancient UFO.
Flying objects.
Yeah, exactly.
Or flying temples, even. I don't know what you'd call them, right?
Exactly. Think about this. Like, you know, the old depictions of the Vimana is a hovering temple, just like this temple. It's very strange.
Oh, man, that's wild. You're blowing my mind right now.
Yeah, it's very, very
strange. One of them that's been parked and they built a temple over
it.
Because it's the only way to hide it.
Conceivably, right? It's strange, right? Now, what I find really fascinating is that with the remote viewing data on this, the plates, and the plates are, like, let's just say one plate is made out of like zinc, another plate is made out of copper, or they're electroformed with different materials. One thing that we've seen in other remote viewing projects when we deal with anti-gravity, unrelated to this, totally different projects, we do see that an aspect of creating anti-gravity, removing gravity, or removing mass, or displacing mass, or creating a portal, is to have these different types of materials layered together in plate-like fashion. So confirmation on the construction in these taskings, you know, from other taskings, right? We get the same thing. Like, this is actually, honestly, like the problem, there really isn't a problem of anti-gravity. The problem is that it's being suppressed, but there are so many people that know about it and are working on it that it's inevitable that very soon it's going to have to be leaked out. It's just going to have to be. It's an inevitability. And so what we have down there are, we've got humans who are messing with this, tinkering with it, trying to understand more on the mechanical side of it. And this is like probably been going on for a while. They can't like get it out, right? And even if they could get it out, how are they going to get it out without people even knowing about it? And they're not going to dismantle it, because they're experimenting with it and trying to understand every aspect of it.
Yeah, they're trying to reverse engineer it, right?
They're trying to reverse engineer it, basically. So they may have found a different way in. We didn't look at, you know, how they got into it, but I think they've been there for a little bit of time. And, you know, when you talk about the riches in there, they don't care about the riches. They don't. I mean, look, when a state can print money,
yeah,
to whatever degree they want to print money, well, what do those jewels even matter? They don't matter, right? It's the technology. That's really what matters here.
That's the value, right?
And we're just talking about Vault B, right? We're just talking about Vault B because in our data, it continues to go downward.
But before we get to going downward from there, who are these people? Are they Indians? Are they our CIA? Are they... like, are they Westerners or are they Easterners? Like, do you have any information on that? You know, with our military industrial complex, any technology that they can get, they're going to go after. They're going to know about it. They're going to go after it. They're going to try to reverse engineer it. So who are the people that are down there? Do you know?
It would be people connected into intelligence and into those ones that are behind the governments, right? Those ones that pull the strings of governments. What you have here is sort of a contingent of people that are in control of things. And, you know, I mean, you've got SRI, who was mapping out the underground area of the Giza Plateau in the 1970s, right, in order to find lost technology. Like, these intelligence agencies have been mapping this stuff out. And my guess is that at a certain point, when instrumentation was sophisticated enough, they detected a magnetic anomaly down there, right, underneath the temple, because this thing would be creating an electromagnetic anomaly. So SRI, it's just to go back a little bit, SRI was the Stanford Research Institute that remote viewing was born out of. So SRI would become involved in strange and interesting esoteric projects, you know, one of which wasn't just remote viewing. It was also to find out what's under the Sphinx, what's under the Giza Plateau, you know, basically back into the CIA.
So, okay. So like totally understand. So now you're saying that this vault is just the beginning of something massive, right?
The vaults go through the ages, right? They go, they like go down, and the deeper you go, the older it gets. And so what you're going to have down there is a lot of historical type documents, lots of historical documents that go way, 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 way back. But this stuff is not going to be brought out for the public. None of this is for the public. I mean, this is the planet we live on, unfortunately, where anything outside of what and how they want you to think about things is blocked, completely blocked. And you're not given the evidence of stuff that's, you know, out there. It seems to be that there were like different vaults for holding different things, right? Vault B has an aspect of it that is holding this ancient technology, the monotype craft, portal technology. Because as I said before, when you get to UFOs and you get to portals, they're essentially the same thing. It's the same mechanics. And we talk about electromagnetic waves causing a standing field in order to displace gravity or create a rip somewhere else. So that's what we're dealing with specifically, like in an aspect of Vault B. But then when you get beyond that, it looks like these things are like little cubby holes, doors, deeper and deeper, where you get into artifacts, historical documents that were handed down and placed in hiding down deep below the ground, because these things were placed in locations to keep them safe from the cataclysms in between the ages. I mean, I don't know what to say other than, you know, this is absolutely incredible, like incredible. But it doesn't surprise me at the same time. And it doesn't surprise me that they've already been, you know, raping the vault for a while, right?
Okay, so how did they get in there? They went from underneath, because that door was never broken. And then
I am guessing they came in through a different entrance, whether there was a hidden entrance or
they portaled in there.
Or they portaled in there, or they drilled in. I mean, I believe that the type of technology that they have can do a man-sized, human-sized hole, right? That can, I mean, it's very, very, very sophisticated.
I'm wondering too, like, were there any cataclysmic events that happened when they found their way into the temple to begin with? Because it seems to have been sealed by spells. And usually if we're looking at like some of the spells that were cast when we're talking about the pharaohs of old and, you know, getting into King Tut's tomb, for instance, and then everybody died who ended up getting in just like they said they were going to, but then the curse basically wore off shortly after, right? And you could just kind of enter at will. Did you see anything related to any cataclysmic events happening from them entering, anything like that?
No, didn't see anything like that. Didn't see curses or anything like that. Nothing like that. You know, a lot of this stuff is propaganda to keep marauders away, you know?
Those marauders. Bang marauders.
You know, some of it is and some of it isn't. I mean, they can be, you know. Well, you know what the Spanish used to do? Like in the New World, what they considered the New World. The Spanish were everywhere, right? Especially like all throughout California. And if they had a cache, because they would be transporting this to ships, the stuff that they looted, the stuff that they got from the ground, whatever, transporting it in big wagons and stuff. If they were going to get attacked and whatnot, or they wanted to put it in a location that they can get back to get it, they would dig a big hole, put it in there. On either side of the hole, they would dig two man-sized holes, and they would kill two people to be on either side of it with guns drawn or a sword drawn, dead in these holes standing up, in order to protect that treasure forever.
Like as if the ghosts of those men would...
Yes. Yes.
And why do you think they would do that?
Because they knew that in the afterlife, these people or beings would hopefully protect it. Like in between places, they would be the treasure ghost. That's actually a lot of what we found with remote viewing on treasures, because we used to do a lot of treasure hunting.
So it was sort of like haunted, just like haunted treasure, which
it would create the haunted treasure, right?
Yeah. Wow. Super interesting stuff regarding the Padmanabhaswamy temple. I really want to know what you guys at home think of this and what John was revealing. I think for me, some of the craziest data that you were talking about were like the layering of the metals to create the anti-gravity when we're talking about the Vimanas, because it just kind of like really hit me like a ton of bricks that when we're talking about metals, we're also talking about different frequencies that the metals.
Exactly. That's what it's about. It's about frequencies.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So if you line the metals up in a certain order, a certain pattern,
with certain material, yeah,
with certain material, the frequencies will interact with one another.
Yes.
And then I just was like, my mind was like super blown. Like there were so many things going on in my mind while you were describing all of that. These things often seem like magic or myths, but it's rather simple, straightforward science that can be achieved just by using the natural substances around us if you know what you're doing. That's what technology is.
Exactly. This is something that actually is has been known for a long time, like this specific way of doing things. It's been known for a long time, actually, and there are devices that were created around this turn of the century, right, that people knew about. You get to Tesla and stuff. Tesla knew about this.
But you know what's funny is it's like it's not new just because like we're aware of what's been going on since the late 1800s. But look where we are right now.
Right.
The most incredible advancements that humans have made have been an iPhone. Like what?
I know. We still use gasoline. Like,
yeah,
we still use jet fuel. We still use gasoline. I mean, what? Like, how did like computers have such a intense like expansion and condensing into this tiny little device that is greater than the greatest supercomputer of the 1970s? One device, yet we still use gasoline. Oh, they want us to use batteries now, but hey.
But yeah, which is like the lithium batteries, which is like, again, though, it's like you're using a
nothing.
That is actually like, it's probably even worse for the earth using the lithium than it is using gasoline. There's
for one thing, they use slave labor to pull that out of the ground. And then the toxicity. Number two is the toxicity.
Yes.
And don't even get me started on those things being just a crazy EMF box that I would never get into. Can you imagine? Like I get into one of those cars and I'm like, I could feel it. I don't like that EMF.
You know, let's look at it. You know, since the 1950s, 1960s, planes have not changed at all. They look exactly the same. They're doing the same thing. They're using the same type of fuel. Why is it that the computers have advanced like this kind of more internal technology? It's pretty easy to realize that this stuff is all about surveillance and watching what everyone's doing to have more of a like a scope over that entire thing. And then all of the real stuff, all of that real technology is, of course, classified. And it's things that we're not allowed to know about.
We've got to make a movement where people can, I don't know, go somewhere in nature that's supported with a facility or something where they can begin to wean themselves off of technology, where no phones are allowed, where they can begin to experience the world actually the way it is, instead of constantly through the surveillance technology state, because that's what this is. And people are addicted to always having that thing on them, always. And we need to begin to break away from that. And we need to start seeing groups of people who are going into locations to remove that from their lives.
So we're talking about the iPhone debuting in 2007. So we're going on almost 20 years now of what it's been like. We're basically cyborgs walking around with these things and we can't let them go. We're using them for everything. It's a very convenient device. But if you look at how it's changed people, is where it gets really scary. You can't see it when you're in it. But actually, if you go into social media and you look at, and you know, John, you and I are from, like I was born in 1980, you were born a little before that. We're talking about like a disparity between people that were born when we were and the people that were born in like 2000 is super scary. They're creating a different language.
Yeah.
Like, they don't actually, things have moved so fast that they don't have the previous generation history like to rely on to learn things. So they're actually starting from scratch and they've forgotten everything.
Right. And I know it's incredible. Like people,
it's scary.
People feel naked if they do not have their phone with them. But a time before these phones was like, you would just do what you did, man. You would look at maps. You would plan your route. You had much higher cogitative process in problem solving. These things are not good. Unless you're just going to become a cyborg, unless that's really what you want and just connected into an internet web interface all the time, which is the direction we're going.
They call it social media, but it couldn't, it's anything but. Like people have alienated themselves from actual social interaction and there's no accountability for what you do or what you say. And people are not being responsible with the things that they say to other people, which sounds kind of funny because everyone's always talking about being offended and stuff like that. But right. In reality, it's like there's way less accountability and you don't get to see a person's reaction when you say something or how you've hurt them, which psychologically helps you, be a better person. It helps right. You develop as a person.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, my dad brought home like a computer and he connected it up to CompuServe. You know, remember CompuServe like in the 1980s or something? He hooks it all up and my mom was freaking out, you know, and then it turns on, it goes, ba-ding, ba-ding, you know, makes that sound. And my mom's just like, no, no, robots are going to take over the world someday. And so like us kids are like, what, you know? And so every time that thing would sound, it would be like, my mom would start raving about robots and the world being taken over, so much so that like, if I hear that sound today, I literally go into an instant PTSD response. And she's not wrong, man. She is not wrong.
She's not.
I mean, it was a little, you know, simplistic, but you know, it's happening. But yeah, so it's tying it back, right? Tying it back to, you know, what we were talking about here is that the advancement that has taken place with computers, electronics, this phone, has been so fast compared to our transportation. And the things that we already actually know that have been buried and the things that exist, like what we have in this temple underground, are the things that have been suppressed and suppressed and suppressed. And they've been suppressed and they will only release the things that will benefit them when it comes to the people. And that's what these phones do.
Surveillance.
Yeah.
That's why. And people blame capitalism and stuff, but really it's like there's bigger things than that are going on. It's not just money pushing this stuff. Because if it was, like, everyone would be flying around in flying cars, you know? Well, before we end this episode, John, where do you think all the Vimanas went? Aside from a few of them being underground in the Padmanabhaswamy temple.
I think that most of them left the planet at the turn of the age, which would be 12,000 years ago before the cataclysm. Mm. That's what I think, because I'm actually a big believer based on remote viewing data in the cycle of the yugas that the Indians have in their old texts.
Do you think we'll ever see any Vimanas here again?
We see them every day.
Where?
I'm not talking about the temple ones, man. I'm not talking about like the flying temples.
Talking about UFOs.
Vimana to me is the same as the idea of a UFO or a UAP, sure. Right? So yeah, people see them every day in my estimation. As far as flying temples, probably never again. Unless that temple's going to fly. Hey, maybe that's what they're trying to do. Fly that temple.
You never
that's
know.
That's pretty crazy.
It'll be fun.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, let us know what you think in the comments below. And yeah, this was an amazing episode. I'm really glad we got to explore this temple because it is such a mystery. And I hope it sheds some light on, yeah, the mystery of the Padmanabhaswamy temple. And are there any viewers from the area who have more info for us from the India area? Please don't hesitate to comment below. Let us know what you think. And hopefully this helped to, you know, reveal the mystery behind it because it's so interesting. I mean, yeah. So, John, thanks so much for being with us. And for everyone at home, we hope you guys thought this episode was as out of this world as we did.